So really rich experience, amazingly rich experience, sounds like. So how did you end up out here?
Again, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I know.
I mean, I guess what I should ask you is, what did you think of New Mexico when you first came out here? And really the question is, why didn't you go all the way to California in that case? Why'd you end up in Santa Fe?
Because I had nothing to do with the – well, actually, oh, okay. Santa Fe is exactly 2,004 miles from New York City. Isn't that interesting?
So Dad threw a dart and said, that's the place.
Right. Well, it had to do with the family's ties with the Christian Brothers, see? And that, you know, the Christian Brothers will watch over me, and they ran that school, actually, at the time. And going back to your question about what did I think of it, I was 17 years old, and all I wanted to do was play jazz and play the drums. And, man, I hated it. Mm-hmm. I mean, really hated it. I got off the plane after an eight-hour ride in the air, a four-engine prop job with a whole bunch of misfits like myself from the East Coast. And when we landed in Albuquerque, we just looked around, and I cried. I mean, I literally cried.
Yeah.
And I said, what am I doing? That's it. My life's over, you know? And I just wanted to get out, which I did. It took me a couple of years, but I got out. And then that's what's so interesting. What happened was then over the years, you know, in situations like that, you develop friendships that are lifelong lasting, right? And so I made some friends, of course, from the East Coast who stayed here and became successful, you know, had good lives. And so when they would come back to the East Coast, they'd look me up and we'd be in touch, that kind of thing. So I was just in 1992 just sort of hanging around saying, you know, I got to get out of here. I need a vacation. I haven't had a vacation in my whole life, you know, and here I am like 40-something years old. And I had a little money for maybe the first time in my life. And I said, where am I going to go? And at the time, Santa Fe was pretty hot, you know, in the travel magazines and all that. Not that I read any of that, but it was hot. And I said, hey, I'm going to go to Santa Fe. I got friends there. I know some people. But I'm going to go, like, for a couple of months, and I'm going to bring my drums, and I'm going to get a gig, man, and all that. And that's what I did. So I drove out, and I brought my drums. And I had no intentions of staying here. I was just going to come out, you know, for a couple of months, and that was it. It was in the summertime. And I just fell in love with it, and I never went back.
So you ended up in Santa Fe.
I ended up in Santa Fe.
Yeah. Okay. So what was that like the first? I mean, obviously, if you stayed, it must have been really, you know, I guess it was a good experience for you when you first got here. What was that like the first few days?
You mean when I returned in
92? Yeah, when you got here, yeah.
Well, I was overwhelmed. You know, in a lot of ways, I mean, I was due for a change and looking to get out of New York for a lot of reasons. But it wasn't an intention. I mean, I didn't intend to come out of here to stay by any means. And, I was just overwhelmed by just how beautiful the place was. And there are a lot of things about it that I really dug. You know, like Santa Fe's a hip town in a lot of ways in terms of you know, I was into eating really well, and there's a lot of that there. And then I was into some spiritual stuff that I had spent some time with, you know, and that was there. And it was sort of like, hey, man, you could be whatever you want in this town. And that's what I dug. I dug that about it. You know, and there was a little music, and that was my fear, that there wasn't enough and I would have to go back because there wasn't enough music. But it didn't turn out that way for me. Turned out good.
Yeah. Well, it still must have been hard to leave New York for maybe good. I mean, when did you realize you were gone for good from New York, really?
Well, I 2 months after I was here.
Really?
Yeah. That was it.
Was that hard?
No, I was ready.
Okay.
Yeah, I really was. I really was. It was sort of, there's a lot of things. I mean, New York's a tough place in a lot of ways. And like I said, you know, when I was young, I had some great gigs with some great people, but still, I didn't make a dime. You know, I could scuffle to live and just living like that and see, when you kind of look at it and another 10 years goes by and another 10 years and you're scraping for the $50 gig. And yeah, there's great players on it, but, you know,
right.
Everybody's scuffling. That kind of thing. So, you know, when I left, it was okay. I was ready to leave in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about it, but, you know, I knew that I had to have enough music here or I'd have to go back. And the interesting thing about it for me when I first came here was that I started getting a whole lot of calls to back up, as a rhythm section player, to back up people who came through, you know, and a lot of it had to with Tom at the Outpost and Bumblebee in Santa Fe. And, all you know, I was playing with James Moody and Roger Kellaway and Nick Brignola and, like, all these great people.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, man, you know, I wouldn't get that call in New York. Let's be honest, man.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And all of a sudden, the big fish in the small pond was like, wow. You know, I always put that down, but it's pretty cool for me now, you know.
Is there any particular... I guess what I was going to try to talk about a little bit was like periods in your life or periods where music was influential or different styles that spoke to you. Like, is there, I guess a good example is for me, there are times in my life where, you know, I have like something going on, like maybe a relationship or a job or some sort of event that music seems to frame.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Sure. Sure.
Is there anything that you have that experience with about being out here, coming out this way, that can remind you of when you first came to New Mexico?
In relation to when I came back here this
when
time?
When you first came, yeah, this time.
I don't know. I can't.
Yeah, that's a hard question.
Sorry, man.
That's not a problem.
No, I was going to say that I had some other influences, but I didn't know where you were going with it. I had some other influences in terms of pop tunes actually.
Okay.
Affect me.
Well, you know, eventually what I'm trying to get around to eventually is at some point maybe like a demonstration of, because you brought your drum set with you.
Oh, that's right. I'm sitting right
there.
Here we go.
You bought the traps.
Well, let me just I'll give you here's a little anecdotal story that's very indicative of, my experience anyway, of living in New York and growing up in New York, right? I was probably about, 13 or 14 or something like that. And I was going to make this, I decided I'm going to go to this place that I heard about, this drum shop in Manhattan, right? Called the Professional Percussion Center. And the in-place for drummers, right? And anyway, so this is big experience for me. You know, I'm going to take the ferry, to bus to the ferry, and I'm going to take the ferry across, and I'm going to take the train and find this place. And on a Saturday morning, I'm going to go, you know, real big deal for me. And I wasn't even looking for anything special, maybe just some drumsticks or something, but I wanted to go to this place. So anyway, I do it. I get up early on Saturday morning. I go into the city. And I find this place. It's all the way on the west side in the 50s, probably, you know, mid-50s on the west side, but like west, you know, 9th, 10th Avenue, somewhere. I don't even remember because it moved a couple of times where it was, but it was somewhere around there. And it was one of those basement, like, sub-street. You had to walk down, right?
Sure.
So anyway, I get there, and then I find the place, and I walk down to the entrance to the door, and the door's open. And I look in, and there's nobody there. So I call, right? You know, the place is completely empty. They must have just opened. It's 10 o'clock in the morning, you know. And anyway, this guy comes out, right? And he asks me what I'm looking for, and I told him, you know, a pair of drumsticks. So he takes out a drum pad, and he kind of puts, there was one there on the counter, and he pushes it over, and he said, hey, hands me a pair of sticks, and says, play something. Let me hear you play something. So I play something for him, and he says, all right. And then takes the sticks back, and he starts to show me another way of playing, and a way of holding the stick and stuff like that. And it's going back and forth, and it's going, and he's beautiful. I mean, he's absolutely beautiful, right? And this goes on. I mean, I don't even know how long, until someone walked in.
Mm-hmm.
And then they needed assistance, so he helped them. And that was it, and I got what I needed, and I left. Well, I didn't realize until years later who it was, right? And if I would have known then, I wouldn't have known anyway because I didn't know who it was. It turned out it was Papa Joe Jones.
Oh, no.
So I got a drum lesson from Papa Joe Jones, one of the greatest drummers of all time in the history of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even know who he was.
Well, there's a mentor for you right there, right?
There's a mentor. Anyway, Papa Joe, I'll segue into that, right?
Yeah. Because
I have the drums. Papa Joe is known for his hi-hat His whole thing, Papa Joe's, of course, coming from the swing era, right, as you know. And in the swing era, the right cymbal wasn't used to keep time. And in the early or pre-swing era or even early swing era, it would be on the snare drum. And so guys would play, you know, coming from those funeral marches. Right?
Sure.
And then in the swing era, it really became... Well, I wouldn't even attempt to try and do what Papa Joe could do, but Papa Joe, it's said, you know, can swung the whole band, the whole Basie band, with just his hi-hat. Didn't need anything else, and it's true. And it's really, really true. You hear some of those records, and I just picked up an incredible DVD called The Sounds of Jazz. It was a 1957 CBS show. It was a one-time thing. And it was all about jazz. And they had, it opens up with Henry Red Allen, with Rex Stewart, and Papa Joe on drums, and Milt Hinton. And they play a couple of tunes. And then there's the Basie band, the whole Basie band.
Wow.
Then there's some other footage, which actually, what's his name, Ken Burns used in that series. And you may have remember this.
Sure.
And it comes from this same show. And it's the whole Basie band. They're all sitting around in a big room, you know, and there's microphones. There's only like a couple of overhead mics. They're facing each other. There's smoke coming up all over the place because everybody's got cigarettes, you know, and smoking like crazy. Right. And they're playing and sitting on folding chairs, right? And there's this footage where there's Ben Webster. Jerry Mulligan somehow is in there with him. Ben Webster, Coleman Hawkins, okay? Mm-hmm. And Ben Webster... And Billie Holiday comes out and starts singing. And then Lester Young comes out and plays after. They all play solos. Jerry Mulligan plays a solo. Coleman Hawkins is unbelievable. And Ben Webster, unbelievable. When Prez plays, it's like, oh, my God. And it was toward the end of his life, you know. But just, you know, a couple of notes and in the right place with that incredible sound, it just transformed the whole band to somewhere else. Really, really amazing.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a great, you know, place to see Papa Joe, because Papa Joe's all over this DVD.
Okay.
Really, really something. And you see that hi-hat work. That hi-hat work is just absolutely incredible. Then what happens then later on is the evolution of it, of playing time. You know, where's the time come from? Like right now, I've been fortunate enough to, you know, Kenny DeVern is here in New Mexico, and I've been playing with Kenny a lot, probably as much as he plays in this area. And it's interesting because, you know, I'm trying to play that style, right? I'm not going to play like bebop, but, you know, it doesn't work. Right? And I wouldn't dare, you know, I have enough respect for the music. And so, you know, Kenny's got me... tune. I don't even use these drums. I have another set that's bigger, you know, loosening up the bass drum and all the drums and having them sound bigger and to create a bigger bottom. And the whole theory and that whole thing is it all comes from the bottom. And it's all the bass drum thing, you know, that creates the pulse, right? So the marching bands, you know, in New Orleans is coming there from the snare drum. Then the swing era... And they used much bigger cymbals, you know, 15-inch hi-hats.
Right.
And, you know, the man is Papa Joe for that. Well, then it goes to the ride cymbal, and this is when bebop starts to come in, right? And, you know, the history books credit Kenny Clark for being the one to bring it from there to here. And so then it becomes... And the whole thing switches to the ride cymbal. But there's all kinds of controversy about who was Kenny Clark, and Max says he was the first one, and who knows, you know, where that stuff is very blurred. Always gets that way. Well, the interesting thing about it is that no matter where it's coming from, whether it's coming from here, it don't mean anything if it don't have that swing,
sure.
Right? If it's coming from here, it's a bass drum, it's coming from the hi-hat, or it's coming from there, right? It's got to have that deep pulse. What happens in the bebop era is then the bass drum becomes a voice, another voice. And so instead of this, which is what a swing era drummer would play, right, the bass drummer. When the hi-hat like that on 2 and 4. This isn't a good example because the bass drum is too small and it's too high-pitched, and you need that whole deeper sound in order to do that correctly. Then in the bop era, so the bass drum now becomes another voice. It's right. Not a timekeeper. It's not a pulse-oriented thing. Well, so I come into the music, right, in the 60s, and everybody's playing like that. Right? And I think that's the way to play, of course. Mm-hmm. And it is for the style, right? But then I realize that It you've got to go back and learn where it all came from, because if you just come in the middle of it, then there's a big hole. I mean, that's been a constant relearning process for me all along, and I think any musician that just keeps going with it is that you have to keep going back to the history
and studying
and
that.
Studying where it all came from, and you learn more about no matter what era you're trying, what genre, you know, what era or time in the music that you're trying to play. You learn from the history of it.
So why? Explain a little bit more about that. Why is that important? Why is that so important? I mean, you said you're losing something, you miss something if you just drop in, you know, at a certain point and don't go back.
Because the elements, swing is so elusive. Okay, we're talking about the drums, we're talking about swing, right? Purely. Mm-hmm. Swing is such an elusive thing. I mean, such an abstract thing. And you're constantly trying to figure out, well, what makes it work? You know, like, why did he play, Philly Joe play that thing right there at that time? You know, why did he play that? What did he hear? What? Because he's a master at it. And, you know, you're trying to learn, right? But you realize that Philly learned from people that came before him, and then you realize what the elements are. Getting back to what I'm saying, it's elusive. So it's not obvious like what the elements are. Okay? Here's an example, concrete example, with the drums. I found out later on, much later on, that most of the bebop drummers, and especially the better ones, right, all along when they're doing this, are playing their bass drum in 4, only they're feathering it so lightly that you can't really hear it.
Okay.
And that's what's creating the difference. Now, it wouldn't be a good example for me to do it on this because of the high pitch of it, but I'll give you an example. I don't know if you can hear that, but I'm playing my bass drum right now. I'm playing it in 4. Now I'll take it away. All of a sudden something gets lost.
Right.
It's missing, you know. And so the point is that bass drum in 4 like this is coming from way back there. All right? And it's not obvious to your ears.
But you could still feel it.
But it's very important to the feel of it all.
That's interesting, yeah.
And a lot of it dawned on me, just not that thing in particular, but a lot of it dawned on me. I went to this this seminar, workshop, I guess you could call it, the Cannonball Adderley Quintet, right? It's about 1970. And I went, and there were hardly any people there. It was one of these things. It was on a small college campus, and I read about it and went there. And if there were a dozen people, right? And it was Cannonball, and it was Nat, and it was Roy McCurdy, Joe Zawinul, and Walter Booker. And what they did was really, really interesting. What they did was each of them wound up tracing the history of jazz on their instrument.
Oh.
And they went all the way back. I mean, Roy McCurdy went back to Baby Dodds. And played in the style, talked about what Baby Dawes did and played in the style of Baby Dawes and Papa Joe and went all the way up. And when it got to Joe Zawinul, they couldn't even get him away. I mean, he would just, he took up more time than anybody. Right. You know? But the light bulb went off, and I went, oh, each one of these guys knows all about the history of the instrument and jazz. And that blew me away.
Sure.
And it was a real big lesson for me. And I was, you know, 19 or something. I don't know.
So right now you're studying, you mentioned a little while ago, before we went on, that one of the people you're studying right now, that you're doing a lot of work absorbing, is Elvin Jones.
Elvin.
Now, why Elvin? Why Elvin now?
It's a simple answer, really. Elvin always bewildered me, as he did and has and probably still does most drummers. I studied with Charlie Persip for about 3.5 years, had a great relationship. I love Charlie. Absolutely love him. And the best part was to hang, man. We even have to, I figured out, be his last student, because then you go out and hang and stay out all night. But Charlie said it, everybody said it, you know, hey, there's me and Max, and, you know, and then there's Elvin. And Elvin is the drummer supreme in a class by himself. And, you know, even though, I didn't know it, I knew it. Everybody knows it. Because what he plays is just not obvious. But yet, you know it's right. Because everybody's playing with him knows what he's doing. And it comes out right all the time, you know. But yet, everything in between gets blurred. And it's sort of like, how does he do this, right? And so what happened, it was just always something that was just so bewildering to me, and I could never figure it out. And so, you know, I was into Philly and so many other drummers, and Philly is one of those, too, whereby every time you hear him, you hear something new. And the same thing I've heard 100 times, I hear the same tune over, and still something, I got something new out of it. Well, after Elvin died, and I've seen Elvin play many, many times. There was a time right after when Coltrane died where Elvin was pretty much a lost soul and had no direction for close to a year or more before he started one of his first bands of his own. And he was going around and to everybody's gig and just sitting in and being a pest and crashing. I mean, ruining everybody's gig.
So how can Elvin ruin a gig?
Well, he overindulged, you know,
okay, gotcha.
in whatever he indulged in. And I mean, I remember seeing in the early days Elvin's forming when he had his own groups, where you'd go hear him in the first set, he'd sound really good, and the second set was like just amazing. In those days, it was 3 sets, right? And then the third set, I mean, he'd come out and fall off the drum stool in the first tune, 8 bars, and that would be it, you know. That was it. Was right. A disaster. That's how he ruined everybody's
right,
gig.
Right.
But anyway, so what? And Elvin's what got me was this: when Elvin died, which is almost 2 years, a year and a half now, I guess it is. Maybe it's close to 2 years now. There's a drummer named John Riley, who's a really great drummer, a well-educated drummer, smart, you know. Learn the hard way. I mean, some guys like have incredible natural talent, right? And John Riley's very successful. Anyway, he writes occasionally articles for Modern Drummer magazine, which is a great periodical, and which is maybe about 35 years old or so now. You know, the publication, and John wrote an article last September, a year and whatever, a few months back, and it was the best analysis of Elvin's playing, of his style and what he was about, that I've ever seen. And it really made a whole lot of sense to me. Not that it's easy. I mean, I'm working on this stuff and it's a long haul. But it made me realize, it explained to me why Elvin is so hard to hear. And the reason is, he uses compound rhythms. And what I mean by that is this. Like, okay, let's say I'm playing. You know, most music is either made up of duple meter or triple meter, right? So the like rock and roll is all duple meter, you know. Okay? 8th notes, 16th notes. You hardly ever hear a triplet, okay? jazz is really based on the triplet. But you'll hear 16th notes. You know, everything is triplet. Right? Okay. So what in the sequence, that's not the word I'm looking for. In the okay, let me put it this way. Here's what our ears are used to hearing. All right, our ears are used to hearing eighth notes, 16th notes, triplets, or compounds. Not compounds of those, but multiples of those. In other words, you know, like if this is a triplet, those are triplets too. Just 16th note triplets, eighth note triplets. Okay,
You're making sense.
All right, so here's what Elvin does. Elvin takes a quarter note triplet, which is a pretty hard one, right? Here's a quarter note triplet. Okay. A quarter note triplet. You can still hear it's a triplet, okay? Elvin takes that, right, and he puts compounds inside of it. In other words, he takes eighth note triplets and puts one of those on each quarter note triplet. So here's what happens. If you have 16th notes, the 16 to a measure. Mm-hmm. Okay? If you have eighth note triplets, there's 12 to a measure. If you have 16th note triplets, there's 24 to a measure, right? All right, these are all the multiples that our ears are used to hearing. Well, Elvin, when he takes the quarter note triplet and he puts three on each one, right, there's six quarter note triplets. All right? And he puts three on each one. Well, that's 18. So we've got 18 notes in a measure. Mm-hmm. Well, our ears are only used to hearing 16th notes, 24, the triplets. That's it. There's a gap in there that our ears just are not used to hearing. And Elvin is playing this stuff where he's got it worked out, and he's playing 18 notes to a measure, or he's playing quintuplets, which are 20.
Okay, so if I'm understanding what you're saying, there's a tension that's created.
That's right.
Doing that.
Exactly.
Okay, there's a tension that's created that draws you in more, I would assume.
It makes you think that he's getting behind the beat.
Okay.
All of a sudden, and you don't feel it, and you say, he's getting, and then all of a sudden, boom. He's right
hits
there.
It
has so much to do with the fact that your ears just don't pick it up.
So you brought in some music, has Elvin on it.
I'm going to try and play some of those.
You going to try to play some?
I'm just very bare bones, right, but give you the idea of what it's about. Okay. So if I'm playing, am I yelling? If I'm playing, I'll give you the 16th note, right? And then I'll give you the quarter note triplet.
Okay.
And then I'll play the compound of 18 notes and see what the... Okay?
Okay.
All right. So here's the 16th note. Okay, now here's the quarter note triplet. So what I just did after I did the quarter note triplet was the compound. So listen to the... Now I'm going to play the 16th note and then the compound quarter note, which is 18. 16 to a bar, 18 to a bar, right? Okay, and then he'll even get into quintuplets where there's 20 to a bar. In other words, 5 to a quarter note.
Okay.
So... No, that wasn't it. That was 16th notes. 16th note triplets. But I'll even get into that. I'd have to do it at a slower tempo. But anyway, the point I think is probably well taken. Mm-hmm. That what he did was just he analyzed in his own way. I mean, his own genius mind. No question about it. Nobody ever did this before. Really, not in that way.
Mm-hmm.
By any means. You know, maybe some classical composer wrote it down on paper
exactly.
somewhere, but that's not like this. Nobody ever did it. And then he'll break it up, you know. And then he'll do the same thing. Then that's, and he'll create 18 of those, you know, in one bar.
Right.
And he'll create the same kind of illusion, which makes it even harder to hear because it's broken up
right
between the drums. It's easier to hear if you're playing it on one drum, you know.